Okay, good evening, everyone. Welcome to the fourth class of the Discovering Buddhism module on refuge and the three jewels. Let's see, do we have anyone who's here for the very first time tonight? Okay, first time at Kadampa Center or just first time in this class? Okay. And hopefully, I think you'll be able to jump in. A little bit of change in the schedule. Next week will be the last class in this module. It was originally scheduled for 6 weeks, but I'm going to be out of town the following week because I was not the originally scheduled person to lead this module. So we're going to do it in 5 weeks, and we'll be able to get all the material in because we've been making good progress. So there'll be a class next week, which is, let's see, what is it, July 2nd? First, okay, next Monday, and that'll be the end of the course. And we'll begin, as always, with some meditation. Begin by checking your posture. I think everyone's familiar with that now. The back straight, but not rigid. Head straight on your shoulders. Eyes either lightly closed or just very slightly open. Mouth lightly closed, not clenching the jaw. Shoulders down, a little bit back so the chest is open. Upper arms a little bit away from the torso. And traditionally, right hand is placed on left with the thumbs touching. If we're sitting on a cushion, we're towards the front of the cushion. So our pelvis is opened up a little bit. If we're sitting in a chair, we're nice and straight. If we need to put a cushion underneath our feet, that's fine. And if we're on the cushion, our legs are crossed in a position that we find comfortable and stable and non-distracting. So check and see if you can identify any sources of tension or discomfort right now and deal with them before we begin the meditation. And we'll begin with one round of 9-round breathing, a deep, intentional sort of breathing. Excuse me. With the stomach expanding on the in-breath, so that the diaphragm is pulled down and the lungs are completely filled, the stomach being pulled back in towards the spine on the exhalation. So it's a very intentional, conscious type of breathing. And we first do three breaths, in-breath and out-breath, through the right nostril. Closing the left nostril, we can either use our index finger. Sometimes people use their fourth fingers. There are different ways of doing it. All of them effective. Then we close the right nostril, three breaths in and out through the left nostril. And then three breaths in and out through both nostrils. And now we allow our breath to return to its normal pattern. And we begin our meditation by setting our motivation, our reason for doing the meditation that's to follow, and as much as possible, we generate the thought that, yes, I'm doing this meditation to benefit myself, to help me become a little bit calmer, more loving, more generous. But I'm doing that so that eventually I can be of greater benefit to others. By getting my own act together, by sitting quietly and working with my mind, I am changing my mind, my consciousness, in a way that will allow me to benefit others. And it may seem unnatural or grandiose, but if we can just think that way for a moment, it's said to be incredibly powerful, the bodhicitta motivation. Said to be the rocket that speeds us on our way to enlightenment, that incredible energy of wanting to help others. That's the force that compels us to become enlightened, because we can no longer accept the suffering of others. We have seen our own suffering, and we see how others are suffering in the same way. And we want to do whatever we possibly can to alleviate that suffering. And we know that the best thing we can do for others is to develop our capacity for compassion and wisdom through working with our mind. And having set our motivation, we now begin the actual meditation. The chosen object of this meditation is the breath, the tactile, physical sensation of breath moving in and out through our nostrils. We place our awareness on that. Nothing more than that. Direct experience, non-conceptual, of breath moving in and out through the nostrils. So it's almost as if our mind, our consciousness, and the breath are of the same nature, are one. Mind on the breath, mind perceiving breath, nothing in between them. And every time we become aware that our mind has wandered off, that it is perceiving something else, a physical sensation, a memory, a plan, we just set that aside and gently come back to the breath over and over and over again. And we can end our meditation with a dedication. Acknowledge the positive imprint that we've made on our mind stream. And think that may that positive energy not be lost, but it may it ripen in the future in a way that is beneficial to all living beings. Any questions or comments on that type of meditation? Simply watching the breath. Okay. It's always a little bit of review. Give people who've been paying attention a chance to show off. The subject of this class is refuge, Buddhist refuge. What do we mean by the word refuge? Shelter, okay? A safe place. Finding a safe place. And what, if we're good Buddhists, what do we take refuge in? The Buddha, okay? By which we mean the historical figure of the Buddha, who lived 2,500 years ago. What else do we take refuge in? Dharma. Which refers to the, God, we got a coughing class tonight. A lot of allergies going around. I've got a little bit of a cough myself. Go ahead and let it out. It doesn't matter if you cough while I'm talking. The Dharma, which is the teachings of the historical Buddha. What's the actual definition of the word Dharma? What does it mean? Or, yeah, that which holds or that which separates us from suffering. Anything that separates us from suffering is considered dharma. And the third thing we take refuge in, sangha. Okay. And what's the sangha? What? Yeah, the community. Yeah, the community of practitioners. We can either refer to the robes sangha, which is people who have taken, who have been ordained, or we can, it's perfectly acceptable use in the more general term of other people who are on the Buddhist path. And refuge is considered the entry into the Buddhist path, the path that leads us from our current state of dissatisfaction and samsara to, enlightenment, which represents, completely developing our capacity for compassion and wisdom. And we refer to these as the three jewels because they're so, once we understand them and look at them closely, they're incredibly precious. They're as precious as jewels to us. Okay? What are the reasons for going, let me get a better pen first. What are the reasons for going for refuge, for taking refuge? Okay, fear. I meant to write reasons, but anyway, you know what I mean. Fear. What do we mean by fear? What are other words we can use there? Dread. That's a good one. And what do we dread? The consequences of our actions, yeah. If this is based on an understanding of karma, the law of cause and effect, that all our actions of body, speech, and mind, determine our future experience. So we dread, if we're honest with ourselves, we realize that we've not always been a nice person, that we've done, said, and thought things that are harmful, both to others and to ourselves, and we dread experiencing the consequences of those, the results, the karmic results or consequences. Not that we're being punished, but in the same way we dread being run over by a car if we step in front of a moving vehicle. Okay, it's not that we're being judged. It's not that we're being guilty. It's not that we're a bad person, but we just understand that all our actions have consequences. And we dread or want to avoid or are tired of experiencing the results of our negative actions. It's very impersonal in a way. There's not a God who says you're being punished in Buddhism. It's the results of your own actions. So we want to avoid future suffering that results from our own actions. So fear is the first cause. The second cause is confidence. What do we mean by confidence? Yeah, we have looked at the three jewels, the objects that we're taking refuge in. We've looked at the shelter. We've seen that it has a roof that's not full of holes, that the walls aren't wide open to the winds and the rain, but we have confidence that it's a valid or reasonable source of refuge, that it's not going to let us down. Somewhat similar to faith, but not blind faith, but faith based on analysis, on reasoning, on looking at our personal experience. It's a sense of confidence. Okay, we're confident that the three objects of refuge are going to perform this, or will be a valid shelter. And that implies that we've looked at them closely, we've analyzed them, we haven't just jumped into it. We haven't set our mind at the front door when we come into Kadampa Center. We bring our mind, our past experiences, our ability to reason, analyze. We bring all of that with us and apply that to the teachings of the Buddha. He said very much, don't take anything on blind faith, but look at it and analyze it. So those are what are traditionally given as the two causes of going for refuge. And then there's a third one that's mentioned sometimes, particularly in the Mahayana tradition, of which Tibetan Buddhism, Zen Buddhism, Chinese Buddhism are part of that tradition. What's the third one that's mentioned? The compassion, okay? And what's the precise definition of the word compassion in Buddhism? Yeah, the wish that others be free of suffering, okay? These two are kind of self-motivated, that we not be free, that we not suffer. And that's completely valid. That's not selfish to say, I don't want to suffer, because the way to, what's the way not to suffer? Well, basically, the simplest way is to have lead an ethical lifestyle, not to harm others. If we don't harm others, we will not suffer ourselves. In simple terms, I mean, that's a gross simplification. But if you want to avoid suffering, lead an ethical lifestyle. I used this last week, as Venerable Rabina says, zip your lips and keep your hands to yourself, okay? Don't harm others, either with your speech or your body. And that's the main way to avoid suffering. So these two are about avoiding suffering for ourselves. And by doing that, we benefit others in that we're not harming them. But also, once we've seen how we suffer, how we have unpleasant experiences in this life, we see that it applies to others also, and we wish for them not to suffer. So that motivates us, the Mahayana motivation that we use before our meditation, to enter into the path, to develop our own qualities so we can benefit others. So that's another reason for going to for refuge. Any questions or comments about that? I mean, that's really the most important material in this class. If you're just clear on that, I think you'll have gotten the core of it. Okay, a comment about refuge in the Buddha. Yeah. Okay, can people hear what's being said here? Yeah. Why don't you try over, because I can't repeat everything. You're saying it so well. Look, do we have the microphone, the hand mic? We're going to record it. Yes, we're streaming live anyway. Yeah, there are probably close to 1 million people out there listening to you.
Thank
yeah.
you very much for that.
All around the world. And they're saying, do I want to be a Buddhist or not? It all depends on what you say here.
Well, basically what I was saying is that Refuge in the Buddha and how it affected me personally, after reading and actually seeing a little documentary about his life and seeing how he kind of tried things that didn't work, and he was not perfect. Had he just been perfect and didn't make any mistakes, like when he was sitting there about to starve to death and understanding, well, this didn't work, and then trying something else and this didn't work, and it really made it real for me.
Mm-hmm.
And not only was he able to overcome all of these obstacles and had just that strength to leave all the richness and all of the glitter and go for it, you know.
Mm.
It really affected me that way. And then once he did do it, and after all that he did to do it, then he had compassion enough to show us how to do it too.
Mm-hmm.
So that really affected me personally.
Okay.
You may have.
So that's I don't need two mics to talk into. Yeah, so that's what we do. We look at the history of the Buddha, his life, and see if that's a valid source of refuge for us. And you're saying that if he had just been perfect from the beginning, it would have been less source of refuge for you. Yeah. Okay, great. Yeah, thank you. Any other comments or questions? Okay.
One of the keys to happiness.
It's on, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. One of the keys to happiness really is having compassion.
Mm-hmm.
And which, you know, aligns with this Buddhist.
Where was that in the news?
I'm thinking it was NPR or something.
Uh-huh. What, some study they had done on
happiness?
Mm-hmm.
I know that there was some discussion on that.
Oh, okay, great.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, thank you. Yeah, we've had one of the teachers who came here a number of years ago say that the more compassionate we are, the happier we are. There is some sadness to compassion. It does, there is a little bit of sad feeling as we realize the suffering of others, but it does. Not happy, joyful, laughing, but it does contribute to inner peace. The more compassionate we become, the happier we are, which is a little something worth thinking about. It, but he's very specific about that. He said, the more compassionate you are, the happier you become. Okay. Any other comments? Okay. Then we talked a little bit about the refuge ceremony, which is a one-time occurrence. It's a decision you make. You have to take refuge from a qualified teacher who embodies the lineage that can be traced all the way back to the historical Buddha. That's considered important. So the refuge ceremony is a one-time event, but going for refuge is a continuous process on the path until you reach enlightenment. And when you become enlightened, you don't really have to take refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha anymore. You're completely wise and completely compassionate. The Buddha said everything he's teaching is just a boat to get you to the other side of the river. When you get to the other side, you don't need the boat anymore. So the refuge is the vehicle or the entry into the path to get you where you want to go. It's not the goal in and of itself. But for us in our current condition of confusion and suffering, the more we can think about our refuge, the more powerful our practice will be. Question? You're saying, is it generally accepted? is the question is it generally accepted that achieving enlightenment can take multiple lifetimes? Well, the Buddha achieved it in the question, it looked like he achieved it in one lifetime, okay? He was a human being, and he sat down under the Bodhi tree, and he got up when he was enlightened. The question was, how much good karma had he created after creating positive previous lifetimes to be able to do that in this one lifetime? So it's kind of like both answers are right. You can do it in one lifetime, but it probably takes the results of good karma from countless previous lifetimes to reach enlightenment. But it can look like it happens in a single lifetime in certain cases like that. Yeah. They say if you're practicing Tantra, which is the most complex level of meditation that removes subtle hindrances to becoming enlightened, you can become enlightened in 3 years, 3 months, and 3 days if you're practicing it sincerely. I don't know. So it's kind of like both answers are correct to that question.
What about, is it also generally accepted that...
But I think... Okay. When you're reborn, are you not a human? I can't give you percentages of which realm you wind up. You know, you spend 30% in this time. Again, we're dealing with something countless lifetimes, so percentages are almost irrelevant. The causes for being reborn as a human are few. The causes for not being reborn as a human are many. So this is a very rare opportunity. They say that for most of us, we've spent more time in the non-human realms than in the human realm. Okay? And again, the cause for being reborn as a human being is, again, living an ethical lifestyle. Being reborn as a human is considered the most favorable to making spiritual progress. But most of us have spent most of our time in other realms, is what they say. Okay. Any other questions or comments? Which is why we want to take advantage of this PHR, Precious Human Rebirth, when we have it. We don't want to waste it because it is rare. It's precious because it's so rare. So we talked a little bit about the refuge ceremony. It's a one-time event. It's taken from a valid master. Geshe Gelug gives refuge here probably about once a year. Sometimes visiting teachers do. It should not be something that you enter in lightly, but something that you've thought about. You don't need to torture yourself about it. If you take refuge and then at some point you decide the Buddhist path is not the path for you, that's perfectly okay. You haven't created any negative karma by doing so. But if it seems to fit with you, you go through the refuge ceremony. And the refuge ceremony comes with various commitments, which we'll talk about in a moment. But also, typically, with the refuge ceremony, you take some vows. The vows are typically offered after you take refuge. So you take refuge first in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, and then you take some vows. And what are the three classes of vows? Again, this is reviewing what we talked about last time. Pratimoksha. What else? Bodhisattva. And tantric. Okay. Pratimoksha vows, tantric vows, you have to take from a qualified master. According to what I read, you can take the bodhisattva vows on your own just by reading them and taking them. What do the pratimoksha vows mean? The vows of individual liberation, okay? The vows of ethical conduct that lead to an end of personal suffering. Okay, so this is an elaboration of what we talked before. The bodhisattva vows are really the compassion aspect. So this would be qualified as the wisdom aspect, which is basically seeing reality, which involves living ethically and not harming others. The bodhisattva vows are the vows of compassion, the wish to free others from suffering. And then the tantric vows, as I said, are to eliminate the really subtle hindrances, very, very subtle karmic hindrances that prevent us from reaching complete enlightenment. Okay? Someone who has completely mastered the wisdom aspect of the path to enlightenment is called an arhat. That's right. Someone who sees reality directly. Someone who's mastered the compassionate side. Bodhisattva. Okay? I'm just throwing these out there because you'll hear these terms a lot if you hang out in Buddhist circles. These are the smart people. These are the nice people. And then you have the Buddha, who is smart and nice at the same time, the enlightened beings, okay? But, of course, most of us are working on both wings, the two wings of the bird of enlightenment at the same time, the wisdom aspect and the compassion aspect. It's not like you just concentrate on one and finish that and then move on to the next one, because they're really flip sides of the same coin. Because if you see reality, you inevitably see the suffering of others. And if you see how everyone's suffering, then you're getting some insight into reality. So you can't really separate them out. Okay, so I'm not going to say any more about the bodhisattva vows or the tantric vows. Those two subjects are the subject of other modules in Discovering Buddhism. Any questions or comments about those? Okay. This will not go on the permanent rector, not being beamed around the world. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, say pratimoksha vows are like a pot, okay, that contains the bodhisattva vows, i.e. the liquid, and the tantric vows are the reflection on the surface of the liquid. I mean, it's just emphasizing how ethical conduct is the cup that holds all spiritual development. I mean, you can't do it without living an ethical lifestyle, which is what the pratimoksha vows are about. You can't, and you know, this is where people get into big problems. They think they can take all these tantric initiations, and you know, they're out drinking and fornicating and stealing and lying, but they say, oh, I'm a tantric practitioner, you know, I'm transforming it all. You know, it's a complete delusion. You know, if you're trying to practice tantra and living an unethical lifestyle, it's like the liquid is just running out onto the sand. You know, it's a disaster. So I think it's just emphasizing how important first the vessel is, and then the tantra is kind of riding on the surface of compassion. Without the water in it, there'd be no reflection. So again, you can't start with tantra. You have to start with the vessel, the ethical lifestyle. And most people will start with the ethical, you know, we'd start with the pratimoksha vows. That's a prerequisite for taking the bodhisattva vows. Okay, so that's why they're done in that order. But it's a kind of a pretty image, isn't it? Yeah. The vessel being the pratimoksha vows, the water in the vessel being the bodhisattva vows, and the reflection on the surface of the water being the tantric vows, the very subtle vows that get us to enlightenment. Yeah. Okay. So there are two main divisions of the pratimoksha vows. What are those? Lay or householder vows, as they're referred to, and what's the other division? What we refer to as the Vinaya, the vows for the robed monks and nuns. Okay? They take a vow of poverty so they can't be householders, for one thing. If you, I don't know if you, all these little things around the altar, those are text. Those are the complete teachings of the Buddha. You pull them out and they're block prints. And it said, I cannot authenticate these, but two-thirds of all of those are the Buddha's explanations of the vows. He considered them so important that two-thirds of his teachings were explanations and commentaries on the three levels of vows. He thought they were so important. We talked a little bit last time about the importance of vows in that it's not to limit ourselves or deprive ourselves of anything, but it's to set boundaries in which we feel safe. And it's also to set boundaries so that other people will feel safe around us. If we're around someone who's taken vows and keeps them, we feel comfortable. We know they're not going to stab us in the back. They're not going to lie to us. They're not going to steal from us, and so on and so on. And it said that's one of the major types of generosity, is to give to others a sense of safety. Okay? We can give the teaching, we can give material objects, we can give a sense of safety, we can give the teachings. Those are the three types of generosity that the Buddha talked of if we're working on practicing generosity. We can give material things, we can give a sense of safety to others, and we can give the teachings, which is what the Buddha did. He can't make us enlightened, he can just give us the teachings. He can't relieve our suffering. Okay, so that's kind of the idea of vows, and they're generally expressed in terms of things we're not going to do because they would harm others and cause suffering for ourselves and others. So we're kind of protecting ourselves. They're a way of protecting ourselves. So the Vinaya, we have there are countless. There are lots of them. And if you ever decide to become a monk or nun, you don't get to find out what the vows are until after you've gone through the ceremony. You know, we have an idea what some of them are, but they're quite a few, and you don't get the full poop on them until after you commit to them. The lay vows, luckily, we know what they are, and we can study them and think about them. What are the lay vows? No killing. Okay, no stealing, no lying, no sexual misconduct. I was waiting for that, okay. Which is generally referred, you know, so you can think of as having sex with someone else's partner. That's one way to think of it. Okay, and the last one is no intoxicants, no recreational drugs. Okay, so when these are offered after the refuge ceremony, which they always are, how many do we have to take? As many as you want to, as many or as few as you want to, based on what you think is a realistic vow for you and one that would have value for you in trying to keep. With the understanding that you won't keep it perfectly, okay, but something that you would like to work on. If you think it's just impossible, don't take that vow. But if you think there's a possibility, if it's something you're going to work on, go ahead and take the vow. Of course, the one with no intoxicants is a big issue for a lot of people. There's no requirement to take refuge that you give up alcohol, for example. Okay, that's not a requirement for being a Buddhist, to give up alcohol. But it is a vow that you can take, and it is to your advantage to take it. But if it's just not going to work for you, you don't have to take it. And this is something you decide on your own. You don't tell the refuge master which ones you're taking and which ones you're not. You just make that commitment during the ceremony, and you take as many or as few of those as you'd like, based on your understanding. The first four are referred to as the four root vows. Okay? And this one is not considered a root vow, and that the problem with intoxicants is not that there's anything morally wrong with intoxicants. The problem is that if you get intoxicated, you're more likely to break one of these vows. That's why it's in there. That's why it's not considered a root vow. It's kind of a contributory factor. Okay? So, intoxicants, not inherently wrong, but it makes you more prone to break one of your other vows if you've taken them. Okay, let's see. Okay, any questions about that? So, getting into a little bit of new material. Let's see how we're doing on time. Running my mouth. Okay. The vow, there are certain actions where it's, if we perform them, it's said that we've lost that vow, that that vow is broken, ruptured, okay? If we kill a human being, the vow of not killing is lost. We have lost that vow. We no longer have that vow. Kill a human being.
Okay.
That's it. Has to be a human being. Okay. To lose the vow. Okay? If we steal something that is valuable to someone else, we've lost the vow of not stealing. Yeah. Before you took the vow, it doesn't matter. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. We'll get to that in a minute, okay? Just say it's ruptured, it's broken, okay? Lying means telling a real whopper, like telling someone you're enlightened, telling someone you've realized emptiness, telling someone that you've seen all your past and future lives when you haven't. I mean, it's a lie related basically to your spiritual path, lying about your spiritual attainments breaks that vow. And sexual misconduct is the one of engaging in sex with someone else's partner. Okay? Those are the four ways those vows can be broken. Okay? If you break one of those, you have to take that vow again in front of a qualified master. Again, you don't tell them that you're that's why you're there, but you sit in on a pratimoksha vow ceremony and you retake the vow. So you can... you can take the vow again, but from the time that you commit that action to the time you take the vow again, you no longer have that vow. Not that you should do lots more killing in the meantime, but you're not getting the good karma of keeping your vows during that time. Okay? You would just sit in on the ceremony and then mentally take the vows that you wish to add to your repertoire. Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay. They're killing a human being, stealing something that is precious to another person, telling a, they call it a supreme lie, but it means a whopper about your spiritual path, and having sex with someone else's partner. Okay? Now, having a downfall in regards to one of your vows means killing a non-human. Okay, if you kill an animal, is considered a downfall in regard to that vow. Stealing something that's not valuable, but just stealing it, is considered a downfall. Ordinary lies, just telling, like, just not a super big lie, but just an ordinary lie. And let's see, sexual misconduct. First, having sex, apparently with your own partner, in the temple on certain days that are considered not auspicious, and don't ask me what they are. While you've taken precepts for 24 hours, having sex during that time, So it gets a little more technical here, okay? But it's not as severe as having sex with someone else's partner or drinking, using an intoxicant when you've vowed to not use intoxicants. Each one of those actions is considered a downfall. It does not break the vow. You still have the vow. You still have the merit of having taken the vow, but you should, in your meditation practice, do some sort of acknowledgement. It says that you should confess. That's the word they use. But it doesn't have to. That doesn't necessarily mean to a teacher or someone else, just to acknowledge that you've had a downfall and commit to trying better to keep that vow. Okay? But you don't have to take the vow over again. Okay? So that's one of the good things about vows. You can always take them over again if you break them, or if you just have a downfall, you can repair them, as they say. Okay? Any questions or comments about that? Okay. So those are the lay vows, five lay vows. Okay. And the Buddha said, in addition, well, he said there are benefits of keeping your vows, not in terms of not just accumulating good karma while you keep your vows, but specifically keeping vows, and that refers to the Pratimoksha vows, keeping those vows prevents you from being reborn in one of the lower realms. Okay? By lower realms, that means these other realms, one of which is the animal realm, and then the Buddha described other realms which we can't see, but he said existed. One is the hungry ghost realm, which is a realm of constantly needing, of being in an existence where you never have enough. Certainly, we get hints of that in the human life, but we're not actually in that realm, according to the Buddha. It's an actual existence that is characterized by needing, by wanting things. And then the Buddha says there are actually hell realms where it's continual suffering. There are no pleasurable experiences. And these are realms that you're not sent to by God, but are the result of your karma. And if you keep your vows, according to the Buddha, you'll avoid being reborn in one of the three lower realms. Okay? Second benefit of keeping the Pratimoksha vows, according to the Buddha, is it creates the cause for you to continue in this life as a human being. Okay, not to stay in this life as a human being as long as possible and to be reborn as a human being again or in one of the other upper realms. There are also three upper realms. The God realm, which is a realm of great pleasure where every need is satisfied. There's the demigod realm, which is pretty good, but not quite as good as the god realm. You have a lot. And then there's the human realm, which is considered actually the most beneficial to be born in terms of spiritual progress, because it's just the right blend of a little bit of happiness, a little bit of suffering, and enough leisure so that we can work on our spiritual path to move forward. So keeping the vows creates the cause to be reborn in one of the three upper realms. Okay, in all three, it's much easier to make progress on your spiritual path than in the three lower realms, which is why we want to be reborn in one of the three upper realms. And ultimately, keeping our vows is the cause of enlightenment. Okay, so these are the benefits of keeping our vows. The Pratimoksha vows, and then if we take them, the Bodhisattva vows and the Tantric vows. It creates the cause not to be reborn in the lower realms, creates the cause to be reborn in the upper realms, and ultimately creates the cause to become enlightened. Okay? More specifically, if we keep the vow of not killing, that's the cause for a long life in all future rebirths. Okay? Not because long life is necessarily good in and of itself, but it gives us greater opportunity for spiritual progress. By not stealing, we'll have wealth in future lives. Whether we're wealthy or poor in this life is a result of how we kept that vow in the past lives. If we accept the concept of past lives, it's not because we play the stock market correctly or because we had wealthy parents. There's actual karmic causes for that. Great wealth being considered the result of good karma in that it gives us the opportunity to practice generosity. It doesn't mean that people who are wealthier are more worthy or better. It's just that they have that particular piece of good karma that gives them the opportunity in this life to practice generosity. Now, they may choose not to take advantage of that. They may have that wonderful karmic opportunity and waste it. Okay, but that's the advantage of having wealth, according to the Buddha. It makes it a little bit easier for you to practice generosity. The first type of generosity, giving material things. It doesn't have anything to do with the generosity of giving safety or generosity of giving the teachers teachings. By not telling lies, by telling the truth, we create the cause for others not to lie to us in the future. And by avoiding sexual misconduct, it means that we will have lots of friends in the future and we'll have partners in future lives who support us on our spiritual path. I mean, lots of times, you know, we're in relationships where we feel like the person doesn't necessarily support us. That, according to the Buddha, would be the result of not having kept the vow of sexual misconduct in the past. So if we want a partner who supports us in our spiritual progress, practice sexual good conduct here. Avoid sexual misconduct. And by avoiding intoxicants, keeping that vow in this lifetime, that creates the cause to have a clear, sharp mind in future rebirths. Okay, a mind that's not fuzzy. Okay. Did everybody get those? Any questions or comments about those? I mean, it's all predicated on the accepting future lives, and that's certainly not a requirement. But if that seems logical to you, and you accept karma as the overriding force that is the way, the reason why things are the way they are, these vows, keeping them, not keeping them, explains why certain things happen to us and why certain things don't happen to us. Yeah.
Let
me get this. Let's preserve this for posterity, for future lives.
I thought the God realms made it difficult to practice because you were using up your positive karma and you were so happy.
Yeah, that's more difficult. Actually, more difficult than the human realm. The God realm is so pleasurable, you don't have the motivation to work on your spiritual path. Okay, you don't develop compassion. Okay, you're just there blissed out like it's like living in Santa Barbara or someplace like that in a big mansion, looking out the Pacific Ocean and having every need. But it is still possible there, and it is still easier there than in the lower realms. You would certainly rather be born in the God realm. It's easier to make, it's hard, but it's not as easy as in the human, not that it's easy in the human realm, but compared to being in a hell realm,
mm-hmm.
where you are just consumed by suffering nonstop, being in a God realm is a more favorable rebirth.
So everyone else in the God realm is also a god?
Yeah, like everyone in the human realm is a human. Okay, for some reason, humans and animals are physically in the same realm. But everyone in the God realm is having a similar experience.
Well, I had another question about the God realm, but
yeah.
That's not for this class.
Well, go ahead and ask it, yeah.
I thought it was, you know, a week before you're going to die, you find out you're going to die and bad things happen. And
yeah, that's the disadvantage. One of the disadvantages of being in the God realm is that when your life in the God realm is coming to an end, you're aware of it, and you are consumed by grasping, by wanting to hold on. You don't want to give up. So that's very difficult to overcome. So again, that takes great spiritual fortitude not to leave the God realm without that clinging, which doesn't lead to a favorable rebirth necessarily.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. Any other questions or comments? Okay. Let's see. And then I just wanted to review the commitments. When you take the vows are generally in terms of things you're going to avoid, things you're not going to do. When you take the refuge, when you go through the refuge ceremony, you make certain commitments, which are things that you're going to do. Okay. But these are not like vows in that you don't have to retake them if you break them or don't keep these commitments. Okay. First one is you should rely on the, I'm going to put them in very simple terms. You should rely on the Dharma. Okay. And practice it. If you take refuge, I mean, that makes sense. Second one is. Don't get overexcited, okay? You should have some control over your behavior, which doesn't mean you turn into stone or a puddle of oatmeal, but a certain sense of start to have some control over your behavior, your extremes of excitement and your negative emotions. Start to zip your lip and keep your hands to yourself. That's a way of putting it, okay? Third one is you should start to develop compassion. Work on developing compassion to others. And the fourth one is, whenever you have a meal or a hot drink, you should offer a portion of it, at least mentally, to the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. So you're practicing generosity. Before you take some for yourself, you know, if you're out at a restaurant, you don't have to sit there and go all woo-woo on everybody and start chanting. And you can just mentally say, I'm offering some of this beautiful food to the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And then you can feed yourself. So it's developing some sense of generosity. And then every morning and every night, you should remember your refuge. You can just, something as simple as saying, I go for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. Three times in the morning, three times in the evening. So those are the general commitments you make when you go through the refuge ceremony. And there's some other guidelines, but those are the things to remember, I think. Any questions?
Why do you have to give an offering to the Dharma if the Dharma is
the teaching of the Buddha? Yeah. That's, it's, you're just offering to the three jewels in general. You know, if you find that awkward, you know, we talked about the inner Dharma as your own potential to become, to understand the teachings, so you could make an offering to that, okay, this potential within yourself. I mean, it's kind of strange to offer. It's not like you're giving a little piece of food to a pile of books or something. But just think of the three jewels. The point, I think, is that the three jewels are kind of living in a way. Even the Dharma is living in a way. So, of course, they're not going to eat the food that you offer to them, but you're being willing to give it to them if they would eat it. Yeah. Okay. It's like putting cookies out for Santa Claus. You know, Santa Claus doesn't need cookies at every house, but it's good to practice giving him, sending out cookies and milk for Santa Claus. Any other questions? Okay. I want to do one more meditation. And this is going to be a little bit different. It's going to be a visualization meditation. And we're going to visualize the historical Buddha, the first jewel of refuge. Is everyone where they can, let me get this, I want everyone to be able to see the Buddha statue on the altar, okay? As a reference for, can everybody see the Buddha statue, the main one in the center of the altar? That's what we're going to visualize, and it's perfectly okay to refer to the statue if you're not clear on what you're visualizing. Don't forget about the three dudes down in front of them and everything else. The three amigos down there, yeah. But the Buddha sitting in meditative pose, he's in human form. That's what we're going to visualize and reflect on the good qualities of the Buddha. And when we say visualize, all that means is imagine. We're using our abilities to imagine. And based on the Buddhist theory of the mind, what we imagine is what our mind becomes. Our mind takes on the characteristics of our imaginations. So if we sit and imagine about sex and drugs and rock and roll, that's the kind of mind we get. But if we imagine the Buddha and his good qualities, our mind starts to develop those qualities also. Our mind is infinitely pliable and flexible. In fact, we can say it is empty of any fixed qualities, either good or bad. It's a vast potential, but that's another course. So again, we'll start do our meditation. Let's just take 3 deep breaths from the abdomen. The abdomen expanding on the in-breath. And take a moment and set your motivation for doing the meditation. And now just a couple minutes of watching the breath, putting the concentration on the breath. And now we begin our actual meditation. The chosen object is a visualization of Shakyamuni Buddha. That's the object that we concentrate on every time we notice that we're thinking of something else. We come back to the visualization of the Buddha. So what we imagine is that Shakyamuni Buddha, in the form that he has in the statue behind me, is in space in front of us. Life size, in space at the level of our forehead, about a body length in front of us. He's sitting in meditation pose. His eyes are slightly open. His hands are in his lap. His body is golden. And he's made of brilliant golden light, almost like a hologram. He's three-dimensional. It's not just a poster. We can walk around him, look at him from the front, from the back. He's sitting on a cushion on an open lotus blossom. He has a very peaceful, calm expression on his face. So we fill in as many details as we can. But the most important thing is to have a sense that the living Buddha, an enlightened being, is in the space in front of us. Life size, about 6 feet in front of us, at the level of our forehead. So just take the next couple minutes to establish the visualization. And again, every time your mind leaves it, just bring it back. So that you're concentrating not on the breath now, but on the visualization of the Buddha. And having established the visualization, we maintain that. And now we reflect on all the qualities of the Buddha that make him a valid refuge. His wisdom, his ability to see reality as it is, his compassion, his wish that others not suffer, his patience, his generosity, his ability to concentrate, his joy in doing good deeds, all of the qualities that make the historical Buddha a valid refuge. Just reflect on those for a minute. And now we visualize that the Buddha moves through space and he comes to the spot above our head. He's facing forward in the same direction we are. And his body shrinks down, gradually becoming brighter. The brilliant golden light becomes more intense. So that he is just a drop of pure, brilliant white light, embodying all his good qualities right above the crown of our head. And that drop moves through our skull and fills our entire body, so that our entire body is pervaded by that brilliant golden light. And we imagine that we have all the good qualities of the Buddha, that in that regard, there is no separation between our good qualities and the good qualities of the Buddha. Our entire body is filled by golden, brilliant light. Every pore of our being. And we are equally wise, equally compassionate, equally loving to the Shakyamuni Buddha. There's no differentiation. And just stay with that experience for the next few moments. And you can allow the visualization to dissolve and end your meditation with a brief dedication. Okay. Any questions about that meditation? Okay. I'd like you to work on that this week and do that 6 days this coming week. Finish the readings if you haven't done so. And next week is our last class in this module. We'll do some refuge practice again. You don't have to have taken refuge formally to do a little bit of refuge practice. We'll go through a couple prayers and things, and that'll be the end of the course. Any questions? You haven't? That will be announced next week, yes. Would you rather have a test next week? There will be some sort of completion exercise. Any questions? Okay, thank you. I'll see you all next week.